Good evening and welcome to tonight's session entitled The New Age, in small letters, Ramtha and the Second Coming. My name is John Magnuson. I will be your facilitator and presenter tonight. And I have been now in the village a couple of weeks. I am a Lutheran campus pastor. And also, I have been trained as a psychotherapist. So I have a special interest in the experience of people. Any popular magazine that you would purchase or radio program that you would listen to probably would have some reference, at least over the last 6 or 8, 10 months, to the New Age. What is it? It has no headquarters, it has no spokespersons, it has no theologians, but there are certain key words that trigger images of the New Age that we could very briefly lift up. Reincarnation, witches, dreams, spiritism, the supernatural. Well, I have been invited to make a presentation and come into dialogue with you tonight. And plan to do that. I bring you four words, four reflections as a pastor, as a Christian, and also as someone who works with a generation of people who are very much being invited and enthralled by what we have come to be known over recent years as the supernatural. So I've asked some help tonight, a couple of guitarists, Dave, and also our recorder, Mike, and they will be assisting me. So I invite you now to come along then, four words, four reflections on the New Age. In 1969, Peter Berger, who some of you know as the prestigious professor of sociology at the New School for Social Research and editor of the quarterly called Social Research, wrote a book. It was called A Rumor of Angels. And its subtitle was Modern Society and the Rediscovery of the Supernatural. That was in 1969. Toward the end of the Vietnam War. And in that particular book, he wrote these words: "A rediscovery of the supernatural will be above all a regaining of openness in our perceptions of reality." The name of the book was A Rumor of Angels. He wasn't sure in his study of American culture, whether in fact it was going to be a renaissance, a recovery of the supernatural. It is now almost 20 years later, And the rumor has turned out to be, I think if we would come into more personal dialogue, we would agree that in fact, with Shirley MacLaine's three-part television series in January, it is here. And the first word that I bring to you tonight about the New Age is that we are in the midst, I believe, of a paradigm shift. Now, the word paradigm has to do with a model of looking at reality, a certain window that we look upon our experiences. And evidence seems to indicate that there is a paradigm shift. Elmer mentioned it last evening in his reflections and meditation. But the way this paradigm shift came about, if you look back in recent history, beginning with the early 60s, you can see the Vietnam War, which of course disillusioned and cracked the society on all levels. There was also Watergate, which busted and disintegrated myths of government officials and our own understanding of patriotism in this country. Also, the escalating arms races and the information explosion, the advent of the computer, has changed the way we look upon the world around us. In the 60s, when I went to high school, the hero of our classes, or in other words, the person we would look up to, would be the young person, young man or woman, at that time the young man, who would have the best marks in mathematics, physics, because he would set himself out to be either an astronaut or an engineer. That was the kind of elite profession in the 60s when I was in high school. In the 70s, that changed, and the new model that came up after the engineer was the business person, the MBA. Now in the 80s, that has shifted. And we have storytellers who are the most prestigious and well-paid people in our culture, among them Stephen King, George Lucas. George Lucas was a 16-year-old dropout out of high school. But he knew how to tell a story. And he knew how to tell a story about another world. And he did it. Those of you who know Stephen King and his horror tales, and Lucas with Star Wars and E.T., the emergence of science fiction in our time is another sign of the paradigm shift. In 1979, I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and heard Rollo May, who is a well-known psychologist in our country. He is a grandfather of certain psychological schools. And he was addressing a number of psychiatrists and therapists, and he said to us, now you're not going to like what I say, but all your jobs out there are limited. The only reason you have jobs as psychotherapists and as psychiatrists is that the myths that have held this culture together are cracking and disintegrating. And people are lost. They no longer have dramas and stories to hold them together. And so we've gone on a solo journey. Every person for themselves to kind of sort out, piece out who they are. And he suggested that there were going to be at least three new myths or stories that would arise in the breakdown of the culture as we know it in the West. One of them was the emergence of the women's movement. He felt that the women's movement was going to change the face of the world forever. And those of you who have been involved in the negotiations for the new Lutheran Church, which they have voted in certain restrictions and mandates, about 50% of every commission and board are to be women. Know that Rollo May was right. The other emergence, he said, of the new story, the new myth, will be one of a new understanding of the earth. There will be a new sensitivity for the earth. And one of the fascinating compulsions that lead many people to the Native community is that link that the Native American people have had in the deepest of their traditions with the earth. The third story, he said, that probably would be emerging in the new paradigm would have something to do with the international family, the global family, and that would be coming out of this information explosion, and we have in our midst during this week two representatives from South Africa to share their story with us. Now, personally, I've found that Rollo May and his talk about the breakdown of a paradigm and the movement into another one has been true for me. When I was 37 years old, that was about 4 years ago, I planted my first garden. I was raised in the city and never really felt it was very important. And so I was 37 years old and I planted my first garden. I was invited to be at Holden Village this summer, and I led a series last week on understanding your dreams. I believe 20 years ago that would almost have been unheard of. But I had a delightful and very moving experience last week being in this community and listening to people's experiences. One of the most startling, reinforcements or reminders to me of the paradigm shift had to do with my preparation for a sermon on Epiphany 2 years ago. And Epiphany, of course, is that season in the year where the wise, that particular festival day where the wise, what we call the wise men, came to visit Jesus from the east. They were following a star. Now, I was taught that they were wise men, or perhaps astronomers. Well, the Anchor Bible Commentary, in the last 15 years, some of you know there's been more research done on the scriptures in the last 15 to 20 years than the last 2,000. So there's been a lot of convulsions within biblical scholarship about what really went on around the time of Jesus' birth. One of the things they discovered was that, in fact, the wise men were astrologers. And the myrrh that was offered to Jesus is the myrrh, the ink, that was used to write astrological treatises. They also discovered on the foundations of Jewish temples are the signs of the zodiac. In our own roots, our own Judaic roots. And if you recall the story that's given to us in scripture and in legend, the astrologers laid their gifts to the baby Jesus. It was the astrological world that led them to Jesus. I don't see any other way you could read scripture except to come to that conclusion in light of the evidence. Also, some of you, I talked to one of the staff members in the village, I will protect their identity, who throws the I Ching, which is an ancient Chinese form of 64 hexagrams. And it is seen with great suspicion among many Christian people. I discovered this year that it was translated first by a Christian missionary in the 1930s. It was a Christian missionary that translated that wisdom from the East. Now, I want to honor the native people who are with us this week. Several arrived today, and they will be speaking for themselves in the next 3 days. But I would like to just give two tributes to some of the traditions that they carry here to us. One is from a man by the name of Eddie Belrose, who is a Cree from Alberta, and I met Eddie when he was coming down as a medicine person or as a teacher. In the native community, medicine means power, healing power. He came down to work with a group of recovering native alcoholics that I was associated with, and the Lutheran Church had been helping to fund a project there. Eddie came down and he said to the community there that his people told him it was now time to come and share what had long been held secret, and that he had been asked by his people to come and begin to share that not only among other native people, but also among non-native people. There is an 8th century Tibetan prophecy which goes like this, that I just heard 2 weeks ago. And the 8th century Tibetan prophecy reads this: when horses have wheels and birds fly with wings of steel, then the people of the white cloud, that means the Tibetan people, will come down from the mountains and will come into the land of the red man, and they will share the Dharma. Now the Dharma means the way. I'd like to close this first word about the changing paradigm, the first word about the new age, with a quote from Annie Dillard, who is a novelist here from the Pacific Northwest, now moved to the East Coast. But when she was living in Bellingham, she wrote a little Pulitzer Prize winning book called Holy the Firm. I read for you just a piece of insight on people like us, most of us, who spend a lot of our time in liturgical or you might say mainline churches. She says, the higher Christian churches, and she's speaking here of Roman Catholic and Lutheran Episcopal, where if anywhere I belong, come at God with an unwarranted air of professionalism, with authority and pomp, as though they knew what they were doing, as though people in themselves were an appropriate set of creatures to have dealings with God. I often think of the set pieces of liturgy as certain words which people have successfully addressed to God without their getting killed. In the high churches, they saunter through the liturgy like Mohawks. Mohawks are native people who make their living in the East Coast, some of you know, as iron workers, high on buildings. In the high churches, they saunter through the liturgy like Mohawks along a strand of scaffolding, who have long since forgotten their danger. If God were to blast such a service to bits, that's one of ours, by the way, the congregation would be, I believe, genuinely shocked. But in the low churches, you expect it any minute. This is the beginning of wisdom. The first word, the new age, accepting, embracing the shifting paradigm. There is more, Horatio, on heaven and on earth than has ever been thought of in your philosophy. Words of Shakespeare. Carl Jung once said, when something is repressed or suppressed in a society, when it emerges, it comes out primitively and in juvenile fashion. And I believe the second word that I bring to you tonight out of my own experience is that the New Age movement is very primitive, it's very juvenile, and it's very undisciplined. Do you remember the women's movement back in the early 70s? When many of our public parks and college campuses were filled with feminist leaders who were burning their bras? Now that has long since passed. But the first cries of the women's movement as it emerged in this culture were very primitive. And you see the same thing in the emergence of the New Age. Sometimes it is an occasion for a good laugh and some healthy humor. I have an article here from the New York Review written by Martin Gardner on Shirley MacLaine and her four books that she's recently written about the New Age. And I'm going to take a chance here and just read just a few of his comments, which are somewhat sarcastic, but I think delightfully written and insightful. So here's a tribute to Shirley, honoring her for her courage in exploring the world that she talks about, but also suggesting that she would do well maybe to put that in some kind of a framework. Let me read for you from Gardner. Channeling got its biggest boost in 1983 when Shirley MacLaine's third autobiography, Out on a Limb, became a top seller. Out on a Limb has two startling main themes: Shirley's undercover romance with a married member of British Parliament and her rapidly exploding enthusiasm for reincarnation and the paranormal. A spirit guide called Ramtha is one of Shirley's top spirit guides. Now, Ramtha is in control of J.Z. Knight, currently the most fashionable channeler in the United States. Miss Knight is a handsome, husky-voiced blonde with an upturned nose who lives in Yelm, Washington. Anybody from Yelm? All right. A small farming community just south of Seattle. When JC goes into a trance, Ramtha takes over to lecture for hours to guests in hotel ballrooms who pay $400 each, or $1,500 if it's a weekend seminar. According to the New York Times interview with Mrs. Knight in 1986, she admits she earns millions of dollars every year from her Ramtha performances and from sales of Ramtha's audio and videotapes and from her books. Gardner goes on to close with a couple of paragraphs, and I'll lightly touch on them. Because of impending natural disasters predicted by Ramtha, quakes, floods, and so on, Ramtha has recently recommended that everyone move to higher ground, especially to the mountains of the Pacific Northwest. So Holden needs to get ready for the onslaught here. According to the New York Times, up to 1,500 people have already moved to the Yelm region. And who's that star of Dynasty? Linda Evans, she's also bought a place now outside Tacoma. Then Gardner goes on, Sandy Falls, a good friend of J.C. Knight when she was Judy Hampton, a girl growing up in New Mexico, told this interview program 2020 about a prayer meeting in which Judy, that's J.C. Knight, suddenly began speaking in a male voice that called himself a demon named Demius. Stephen Baker, formerly J.C.'s advance man, told how devastated he became when during a desert hike he observed Mrs. Knight smoking and practicing the ram's gestures, slipping in and out of her Ramtha personality without bothering to have a trance. Now divorced, Miss Knight continues the hobby she and her former husband had of raising Arabian horses. According to 2020, she began selling them to followers who were told that the ram had recommended the purchases. One woman paid $250,000 for a horse. Washington State issued a cease and desist order, which J.C. accepted. Naturally, she sees nothing wrong about such trance chiseling because she sees nothing wrong about anything. Martin Gardner, The New York Review. I guess to get a little less sarcastic, and perhaps more helpful, I would say one of the great dangers from my experience about working with people that have entered the world of the New Age in an intentional way is that it features or lifts up what I call the solo spiritual journey. And it has no real call to community, and it has no call to ritual. And it has very little accountability. One of the things that the Native people can share with you this week that I have learned from them is how important ritual is to go into the spiritual world of which they and their people share. And that there is no access without ritual and without community. An ancient Christian truth that the New Agers in and out of the church have, I believe, these days, forgotten. The first word, a word of blessing, a word of welcome to the new age. The second word, a word of warning. A warning against a lack of community, a lack of ritual, a lack of accountability. A third word tonight has to do with what I'm going to call a celebration of mysticism, or a celebration of the mystic experience. I've got the arrows and the circles. Martin Luther once wrote something that very few people like to quote anymore. He wrote, "I don't care what Jesus said, and I don't care what St. Paul said. What do you say?" He was pointing back to the primacy of personal experience in terms of expressing a fundamental encounter with God. Lutherans come up very, very short on talking about human experience. That's been my experience. But Fred Buechner, who again Elmer quoted last night, has a wonderful opening to his little book, Alphabet of Grace, where he says, for Luther, it was being struck by lightning when he was 12. For St. Paul, it was being knocked off, literally off an ass, blinded. From Martin of Tours from Hungary, who we had one of our community leave from that country, it was having a dream in which he gave his cloak to a poor man who later turned out to be Jesus. It was a personal experience in each of those cases that was the fundamental pivot in their own spiritual journey, and that is one of the unique dimensions of the New Age. The primacy and emphasis it puts on individual personal experience. Now, as a pastor and as a therapist, one of the most helpful frameworks to deal with this whole business of personal mysticism or mystic experience has been some insights from a German theologian 100 years ago called Rudolf Otto. He wrote a little book called The Idea of the Holy. And in it, he talks about two dimensions of the encounter of God. He says, when you encounter the presence of God, it's like you're being hit at the same time with two things. One is, he's got a fancy name for it. He called it Mysterium Tremendum et Fascinans. It's Latin. It means when you encounter God, when you encounter the tremendum, one part of you is drawn to it, overwhelmed by it, overwhelmed by a sense of oneness, of God's grace, of forgiveness, of unity. Of connectedness. And those of you who have been walking in these mountains, you can have experiences like that. You can have them other places too. You can have them with your girlfriend or your boyfriend. You can have them reading scripture. You can have them in church. Most of mine have not happened in a sanctuary, in a normal sanctuary, but they can happen there too. There are moments that Tillich calls are moments when you are accepted, whenever the future is okay and the past is forgiven, it's the eternal now. But Otto also went on to say there's another experience in that encounter with God that happens alongside, not at the same time, but it's another dimension of the same encounter, and he gave it another name. I'm calling it the experience of the ascetic, or it's the experience of the ought. It's the experience of the distance, not the closeness, not your oneness with God, not your feeling of closeness with the love of Christ and his power for you, but the distance between your own finiteness and the infinite power of God. It's the stuff that your grandmothers used to come to church 45 minutes early for and just sit there because they knew that they were about to enter in that worship service the presence of God. And it's the same reason they told their grandchildren and many of you not to run in the sanctuary. That has been forgotten in many of our contemporary churches, that presence the infinite power of God. Now that second expression, the distance, is best expressed with from the monastic community by Henry Nouwen, for instance. When he talks about the distance you feel from God is just as important as the closeness you might feel with the power of Christ. Do you remember how our liturgy begins? Lord, have mercy. When I sat in the sweat lodge for the first time 5-6 years ago, I remember as our leader began the ceremony, he said, "Grandfather, have mercy on us two-legged creatures." Same prayer. As you approach the power, you come with respect, you come with humbleness. Now, what I would like to suggest is that the New Age doesn't take both these. It takes one and lifts it up to celebrate it. I believe it takes the mystic experience, which is basically an empowering experience, an experience of unity, of oneness, of connectedness, and lifts it up and celebrates it as the experience of God. And in that sense, I think it is a powerful experience, but I think that it's also incomplete. One of the things you don't run into a lot in New Age movement people is much of a concern for ethical problems. One of their great spokespersons, David Spangler, says, the great thing about the New Age is that it helps people learn that inside of them they carry a powerful world. And it teaches you how to use it. Intuition. But the thing it doesn't teach you how to do is to relate and love other people. It kind of tries to explain things away instead. I saw an interview with William Duffy, whose parents were murdered in Montana. He's another Dynasty actor, isn't he? William Duffy? Yeah. His parents were murdered, and they interviewed him, and his attitude toward the murderers was fascinating to me, because he's a New Age man. And he said, well, they were doing their karma, something they had to do. There was a certain kind of way that you looked upon the world that didn't reflect the kind of outpouring love and the sacrificial love that calls us as Christians into and for the world, into the world to die and to live for it. That was absent. I want to just say that the mystic tradition in the Christian church has always been there, but we haven't talked about it much. And now it's beginning to surface again, especially through the Roman Catholic Church. Meister Eckhart, Thomas Merton, Edgar Cayce was a disciple of Christ, member all his life. And if you ever want to read a story, a wonderful story of a man with great psychic, he'd definitely be a New Age man, remained a member of the Disciples of Christ all his life, had a tremendous psychic gift for healing, never left his church, refused to accept any money for what he did, and suffered tremendous tragedy in his own family. Edgar Casey. Matthew Fox is probably the most well-known and, you might say, the contemporary pop theologian when it comes to mysticism, a Roman Catholic writer. I'd like to just close with one brief celebration of the mystic experience that oftentimes New Age people carry to us, that we like to frown, or we don't like to frown, but we tend to frown and be very suspect about. We don't expect miracles. We never see them, you know, except secretly. Then we don't talk about them except quietly. I had a conversation with a physician, a family physician in Oregon, who's a friend of mine, a highly conservative doctor, who came to me with a story that he could not explain. And a woman had lost her son, 10 years old, from leukemia. And he told me over lunch one day, he asked me what I felt and what I thought, because he could not himself make sense out of what she had said. She had come to him and said that her boy, who he had been watching as a physician for a year, had finally died of the terminal illness. And the day he died, she came in. His head was shaved. He could not lift his head from the pillow. And he said to his mother in the morning, he said, "Mom, I know why I'm sick." And his mother did not ask any questions, just left. He was very, very tired, and then came back in the afternoon, and he looked up at her and said, "Is it okay?" She looked at him. She had no idea what he meant, and he asked it again, "Is it okay?" She went out in the kitchen. There was a neighbor there, not a professional nurse, not a pastor, a neighbor who knew how to listen with her heart, and she said to the mother, who was very distraught at this point, "What am I supposed to say? I don't even know what he's asking." And the neighbor said, "It doesn't matter what he's asking. You feel in your stomach, you feel down here. And you tell him what you need to tell him." She went back and he looked up and said, "Is it okay?" And she said, "Yes." He laid his head down and he died. Now, what was happening? And what happened? Hallucinations, perhaps. Or did the boy see something? Was the boy trying to help the mother let go? Those of you who have been to an Indian funeral, a native funeral on a reservation, they understand this. And there's a tremendous celebration that goes on. "When I die, I want to die on a reservation, Irma." No. In the white community, you can't even get off from work sometimes to go to a funeral. In the reservation community, the whole place shuts down for 3 days. And you eat and you sing and you talk to help that spirit, to help each other make that passage. The mystic experience, incomplete, but an important part of our faith, brought to us by the New Age. The last word I bring tonight has to do with boundaries. I've drawn a circle and a square, because this is the one you all have been waiting for. Well, what's the difference? You know, what can the church say to the New Age? There are some differences between us as Christian people and some of the basic tenets of many and much of the New Age material that you read and that you hear. Shirley MacLaine et al. And I think a very helpful book on this is written to us, comes to us from InterVarsity Press. You know, God uses all kinds of publishing houses, and although I sometimes, those folks sometimes become my antagonists in campus ministry, now they become my allies, and it was written by a man by the name of Gruthius. It's called Unmasking the New Age, but written from a pretty conservative point of view, but I would say He tends to write off yoga, you know, don't do yoga, much less alone Tai Chi or Do the I Ching or listen to your dreams or anything like that. But he's interesting still, in light of that conservative approach, what he does not say. First of all, he does not say that the New Age is a conspiracy. And you hear that from a lot of conservative Christians, that the New Age folks are out to take over the world and this is the Antichrist. Now, Grotius, who's quite a renowned conservative, very deliberate, well-articulated attack, he says, when you hear that kind of talk, it's a little bit, you're dealing with a paranoid Christian community there. There's no evidence that there's some kind of great conspiracy going on to pull down the church or to violate the basis of American beliefs. Second thing he does not say is everything in the New Age is satanic. So even this man says, well, now we have to be careful. Not everything that is called New Age is satanic. In fact, he goes on to say, there are certain ways of knowing, intuitive ways of knowing, holistic. John's been talking about that this week and will be, in terms of as an artist. Personal, that is all supported biblically. And then he even goes on, and granted, it's only one sentence in the last chapter, and you have to dig it out. It's like a needle in a haystack. But at the end, he says, we need to look for common ground with the New Age. So now that I've set the stage, let me give you both his critique but also mine. Four differences that I believe we come as a Christian community in terms of dialogue with the New Age movement. Number one is the understanding of sin is minimized among New Age people. It's like if you know enough, there won't be rebellion. There's a difference between us. We have a more pessimistic view of nature. That's what it comes down to. The mystic experience, you see, is a sense of oneness, not separateness. And as a result, there's a focus on everything will work out if you do your karma or whatever it is, the path that you're walking. Now, William James, around the turn of the century, wrote a book called The Rise of Religious Experience, which he talks about mysticism and the insight of it, but also the danger of it. Because there's a certain optimism. There's an optimism in New Age people. Those of you who have talked and have New Age friends, it's like their eyes glitter. And when you raise questions of South Africa, you talk about Indian policy or federal governments and struggles in the church, their eyes kind of glitter and they change the subject. Well, here's what William James said, 80 years ago. He said, this mysticism, optimistic look at the world will work with many persons. It will work far more generally than most of us are ready to suppose. And within the sphere of its successful operation, there's nothing to be said against it as a religious solution. So he's not attacking it, but now listen to what he says. He says, but it breaks down impotently as soon as depression comes. And even though one might be quite free from depression in oneself, it's inadequate as a way of looking finally at the world because the evil facts which it refuses to account for are a genuine portion of reality, and they may be, after all, the best key to life's significance and possibly the only openers of our eyes to the deepest levels of truth. Then he ends with this statement. The completest religions, he said, would therefore seem to be those in which the pessimistic elements are best developed. Buddhism, of course, and Christianity are the best known to us. Now, that was at that time of these. They are essentially religions of deliverance. So, what James is suggesting here is that New Age people sometimes tend to overlook or don't take seriously the power of evil in the world and our own rebellion and sinfulness. And if you look at the New Age movement, there's a lot of charlatans, a lot of people making money. Now, granted, you can say the same thing about the Christian community, but not to the extent, I believe, of that emerging group. So that's the first comment about the understanding of sin is minimized. The second one is the divine and human are blurred. Did any of you see the series on television with McLean? Okay, do you remember when she stands on the beach and says, "I am God, I am God"? They shout, "I am God, I am God." Well, she's not God. But she's shouting she is God. And one of the New Age things is the God within, that we are God, that we are God. There's an optimism. Again, David Spangler says, the problem with the New Age people is that God is so small. Now, Spangler is a New Age philosopher himself. He said, why don't they take an image of God as a child or of a suffering servant? But instead, McLean doesn't say, I am God, I'm a suffering servant. She lifts her little chest out there and yells into the Pacific Ocean, I am God, I am God. God is power. What does that remind you of? God is power. Is that biblical? That's what man wants God to be. Remember Luther? What do I think of when I think of God? A man sitting on a throne? No, a man hanging on a cross. That's one of the differences, distinct differences between us as a Christian community. Thirdly, I mentioned it earlier, there's a lack of the ethical because the New Age features the mystical. And there's a lack of a commitment to the world, of us, especially the sacrificial love that you see in Christ. And that I think you hear in forums and the kinds of issues that try to elicit and call from you through your offerings and through your time and talent kind of a down payment on the kingdom of God in the world. Lastly, again, the New Age movement calls us in a good way to use and bless the power of our inner world. But it does not help us in learning how to love one another. I would like to close with just a comment from the 27th chapter of Matthew, a resurrection story. Do you remember Jesus is sitting, or I should say, Mary comes to the tomb with the other woman? The tombstone is rolled away. They can't find him. The body, and they're in the garden. They see a gardener. They don't recognize who the gardener is, and then the gardener says, Mary. And Mary turns and says, Jesus. It is the personal word that touches and calls Mary into recognition of the Lord. And if nothing else, I believe the New Age brings to the church a reaffirmation of the personal word that can transform, bring us into wholeness. This has been Holden Village's version of New Dimensions. Thank you. We're being slowly invaded here, appropriately so, for Vespers. And I've not left much time for questions, but I'll be around tonight and encourage you to talk to each other and push your own boundaries, share your own experience. See you during the rest of the week. Thank you.